From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I'll talk with sports writer Frank DeFord. As a senior writer for Sports Illustrated magazine and a longtime commentator on NPR's Morning Edition, DeFord has written about everything from the Super Bowl to an obscure football coach in Mississippi. Also today, I'll speak with jazz musician Ornette Coleman. His music has been at the forefront of the jazz avant-garde for 30 years. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward remembers the man known as Mr. Blues, and our book critic John Leonard reviews Orphans, Real and Imaginary by Eileen Simpson. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is sports writer Frank DeFord. He's a senior writer for Sports Illustrated, having joined the magazine in 1962, right out of college. His specialty is the long feature in the back of the issue. His subjects have included the upbringing of tennis star Jimmy Connors, the debut of jockey Steve Coffin, and pitcher Jim Boughton's comeback attempts. Since 1980, DeFord has been a regular commentator for National Public Radio's Morning Edition. He also does commentaries for NBC Television. He was voted Sports Writer of the Year four times by the National Association of Sportscasters and Sports Writers. In 1983, he wrote a very personal book about his daughter Alex's losing battle with cystic fibrosis. The made-for-TV movie adaptation of Alex, The Life of a Child, was recently rebroadcast. Frank DeFord's new book is a collection of what he considers his best pieces from Sports Illustrated. It's titled The World's Tallest Midget, and it's just been published by Little Brown. Welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you, Terry. Nice to be here.
The title of your new book is a reference to how constantly disparaged sports writers are. You want to explain?
Yes, I think that generally we are put down. I said in the introduction that it's an odd thing, but the genre of sports writing, most people assume the worst of it. The worst of sports writing is taken as representative. And I said in there that anybody who wants to be a good sports writer is usually viewed as wanting to be the world's tallest midget, and that from thence came the title.
Which came first for you, your interest in writing or your interest in sports?
I think my interest in sports, like any kid, was always there. But my interest in writing certainly superseded my interest in being a sports writer, if I can put it in that order. I wanted to be a writer and ended up as a sports writer without ever intending to be one.
You've been working for Sports Illustrated basically since you got out of college.
Yes.
And in there you've been able to do long pieces. Did you ever do the kind of daily journalism that sports writers for newspapers do?
No, and I think that's probably the reason that I've stayed in it. I don't think that I could have been a sports writer for long if I had had that kind of burden on my shoulder. I don't think I could have even covered... When I first came to the magazine, I covered a lot of sports and did deadline stories. I was really wearing of that after 4 or 5 years. And I think I've been lucky, number one, that Sports Illustrated has given me the vehicle to do the kind of stories that I really like. And number two, that sports itself has kind of exploded. And the kind of stories I do, I don't think I could have done them 20 or 35 years ago or 40 years ago because they just sort of weren't accepted then. You were supposed to write little sort of John R. Tunis hero worship stories, and sports people were not supposed to be written about seriously. So I'm very lucky in that regard.
What didn't you like about the idea of daily journalism or of deadline journalism? You get tired of describing one game after another?
Yeah, I don't think I'd have been good at it no matter what I was writing. It isn't so much that I wouldn't have been a good deadline sports writer. I would not have been a good deadline writer. I think I'm more – I guess we're all hybrids in this business, and I think I'm more of a writer than I am a reporter. And ultimately, I think that would have won out, and that's really the reason. It isn't the subject matter so much as the pressure of that.
You said that the sport you most dislike writing about is football. Is that because of the people who play it, or is it something intrinsic to the sport?
It's more of the difficulty of writing about the sport. And it's my theory, and I think this is fairly obvious, this isn't like I'm coming in from left field, it's that the hardest sports to write about are those that involve the most people. I mean, that's simply a dramatic verity. football has these thousands of people, like Mongol hordes, that play in games. And it's very, very hard to focus in and get the drama of it. I said in the book that it's a little bit like nobody writes very well about the House of Representatives either. And that's for the same reason. And what sports writers write best about, the good ones, are about individual sports. I think maybe the one exception to that rule may be baseball. In baseball, you've got the pitcher versus the batter, which is kind of an individual confrontation within the context of a team game, which is maybe what makes baseball such the preeminent intelligent sport that it is. But football, what football lends itself to then is because you can't write about the people very well, then football writers invariably write about the strategy and the X's and the O's and that interminable nonsense that goes on. And football is really the worst written sport of all.
Well, you do a lot of almost psychological profiles of people. You go into their past, their relationships, how their relationships bear on the game that they play and the way they play it. The cliche way of thinking would be that would be harder to do in football because football players would be less reflective. I don't know if there's any truth in that or not.
Are football players less reflective? I don't know if they are. I think they're less liable to talk. They may be reflective, but I think it remains within them. Again, if I can keep this stereotype going, I think that somebody who plays football wants, in effect, to get lost in the crowd. Whereas whether you're playing tennis or ice skating, I think you're more likely to be kind of an extroverted person and a loner and liable to reflect out loud. Football players are not, as we say, very verbal. I think that would be the difference, though, of course, there's all kinds of exceptions to these rules.
Does doing long pieces as opposed to daily beat journalism get you out of the obligatory locker room interviews where you ask someone about the game after the game, it's a really great game and got a great ball club?
The other thing that drove me out of locker room interviews was being in the locker room, where most of the time you're interviewing somebody without any clothes on. And that's very disconcerting. And people used to say, well, that's all that the women want to do, the women sports writers, is get in there into the locker room with a bunch of nude men. Well, let me assure you that whatever the gender involved, it ain't worth it. It is a very, very discombobulating situation. And I'm always amazed, though, at these athletes who can sit there buck naked, kind of toweling themselves off and carrying on a relatively normal conversation with 20 people with their clothes on. It kind of amazes me. But it's really not the sort of situation for good dialogue. And that drove me out as fast as anything else.
Is it the kind of thing where you want to stare and know that you shouldn't?
It's hard not to. I mean, it's not a normal situation. I've said in the past that you can have some good conversations when everybody has their clothes on, and you can have some good conversations when everybody has their clothes off. But it's this sort of halvesies element that makes it very difficult to concentrate on the questions.
I always have the feeling you never really get much anyways when you do the locker room interviews.
You get
cliches and...
You're really getting the surface stuff. What did you throw? Well, it was a curve. He had a curveball. I really got hold of that. We didn't mean to call that play. I checked off at the line. You get those sort of things. It's very rare that you get any kind of thought. And you certainly don't get to the bottom of people under those circumstances. And again, we get back to the fact that I'm just really not interested in that kind of deadline journalism in the first place, whether it's in the locker room or the parking lot or on the bus or wherever.
Sportswriter Frank DeFord is my guest, and there's a new collection of his pieces called The World's Tallest Midget. You've been writing since 1962, and you say that you came in on the cusp between the period in sports writing when sports writers were really two-fisted drinkers and now when they'll indulge in an occasional glass of wine. Yeah. What happened to change sports writing?
I think it's what happened to change the world. I think that there have been that kind of evolution everywhere, and I think this too. One of the reasons that sports writing is not as bad as it's portrayed is that it hasn't kept up with its reputation. We have much better, more intelligent people writing now. I think that in the old days, there was a tendency to get sort of the leftover element for sports writing. If you couldn't do anything else, you were sent out to cover the football game. Or if you were just kind of a cheerleader, you were sent out to cover the football game. There was an awful lot of people who got into sports writing simply because they couldn't play and weren't smart enough to coach and didn't know how to bandage people, so they couldn't be trainers. So by process of elimination, they became sports writers. And we do have a much brighter group of people around now, thank the Lord, and much better writers.
You know, I'm surprised you keep talking about sports writers' bad reputation, because it always seems to me that everybody says the best writing in the newspaper can be found on the sports pages, and there's been so much praise lately of sports writing.
Well, I think most people think of sports writers as Oscar Madison. I mean, nobody deals in stereotypes better than Neil Simon, and that was the classic, The Odd Couple, that stereotype. But there has been as well that cliche that you suggested there, where the best writing is found on the sports pages. And I'll buy that. That's probably been true for a long time in a lot of papers. But the companion cliche to that, which was also very true, like most cliches are, is that the worst writing was also found on the sports page. So that you did usually have one good writer per newspaper. Who had a certain amount of intelligence and rhythm and was able to write, and he was surrounded by the dregs, simplifying it. But, yeah, that was true. I think you've got to remember about sports writing is what a neat thing to write about sports. You got everything there. You got the drama. You have very obvious characters. You have wins and losses. You have people who, by and large, are pretty expressive. And they're fun, and they're young, and they're still innocent enough to tell you things, and so forth. And so it's pretty hard to screw it up if you've got any talent whatsoever. I mean, imagine, I think sometimes, of being like a political writer. Or have you ever written about entertainment figures where you are they're practically put in one of those bubbles, surrounded by publicity people, and they will only speak to you when it serves their purpose, and so forth. You compare sports to that, and it's an entirely different world. It's in a way, it's kind of surprising we haven't had more talented sports writers, because the subject matter is so darn good.
You've alluded to how in your profession of sports writing, years ago there was a lot of under-the-table bribing that promoters would smear someone in order to get a good story written in. Had that stopped by the time that you started writing?
The only kind of bribes I ever got early on were suggestions that if I wanted a woman for the night, they were available.
Really?
That was early on. I don't think I've had one of those in the last 20 years. Maybe I'm just getting old.
But who would offer it?
Oh, you'd come into town to do a story on X team, and the general manager would say, "Everything okay? Can I?" You know, it was pretty obvious. But I think by that time, the situation had begun to change. What you used to get was, like, if you were the boxing writer in X town, it was understood that you were going to be on the take. Part of that was that all journalists, and not just sports writers, were so badly paid that it was almost understood that they were going to get money on the side. You had an awful lot of kind of quasi-bribes, which continued, I think, probably into the 1970s, where the sports writer covering the local basketball team would also write articles for the program and get paid for that, and probably get paid out of context. And so there was a little bit of that that went on too. People doubled up. And again, I think that began to fade when you got, number one, when journalists got better paid, and number two, when a little more honorable group came in. Dick Young, who's often vilified, writing then for many, now for the New York Post and now for the New York News, earlier for the New York News, when he took over the job as the beat writer for the news for the Brooklyn Dodgers, he went and told the news he wasn't going to take the job unless the news started picking up his tab. Before that, the ball club would pick up the tab. Now, that was in New York for a major newspaper.
So you're beholden to them.
Yeah, you absolutely. They paid your travel. They paid your hotel. And then you were supposed to turn around and write critically or just objectively. And that sort of system, thank the Lord, has finally gone out.
Well, I think more than any other writer in a newspaper or in a magazine, that sports writers are expected to be fans and cheerleaders. Mm-hmm. You're supposed to have a home team and cheer for them and so on. Is that still the case?
Oh, that's the hardest thing. That's another reason I don't think I could have been a beat writer, because that's a very hard thing to do. You travel with a team. you live with the team. In the old days, of course, on trains, they practically literally lived together and played cards and ate breakfast together. And then you're supposed to be as objective as you possibly can day in and day out. And it is a very difficult thing to do for even the most superhuman kind of journalist. But it's also true that the fans expect you to be the cheerleader. And this applies most of all, Terry, in small communities. The smaller the community, in other words, the guy who writes football for Alabama, oh boy, he's got a harder job than the guy who covers the New York Yankees, even though it's the same principle.
Because they're fiercely loyal.
They're fiercely loyal, and you are considered to be a traitor. The letters of General Sherman that have been uncovered and are out now, his views on the press in the Civil War, approximate what most fans and certainly what most athletic directors and coaches feel about the press in those kind of parochial situations.
So you're kind of free of that in a national
setting. Oh, national, you're fine. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I've come into cities sometimes, and the local beat writer has said, hey, look, I want to tell you that the tight end and the quarterback hate each other's guts and the so-and-so and the assistant. And I said, gee, that's fat. I haven't read that anymore. He says, I can't use it. So there are limits even that you have to put on yourself. And as a national writer, you are above that.
Sports writer Frank DeFord is my guest. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a few seconds. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live from WHYY in Philadelphia and is distributed by National Public Radio.
Sports writer Frank DeFord is my guest. He's a senior writer for Sports Illustrated and a regular commentator on National Public Radio's Morning Edition. He has a new book that's a collection of Sports Illustrated pieces. It's titled The World's Tallest Midget. You've described British sports writing as being the strongest influence on your writing. I'll confess that I've never read any British sports writing, so I'm not sure how it would influence
you. You've read British writing, and it's probably not a whole lot different than the rest of the British school. Basically, British writers, and I was astonished to find this out when I was in my 20s and first experience, they write about games more as reviews, as theater reviews. American writers are horribly literal, and they're also the worst, is they're so dependent on quotes. You can't say somebody played a good game or a bad game. You've got to go down and get the manager to say that. And the British writers, often, though I'm afraid they're being inducted into the American school, often they wouldn't even go to press conferences. They didn't want to hear some guy say he played well. That was what their job was to describe that. And I was very taken by that when I first saw it. And on top of all that, of course, British writers are a whole lot more literate and care a lot more for the language than American writers. And so that kind of made me feel good because that was the way I wanted to write. And I saw it there, and it was lovely. And it has had an impact on me. There's no question about that.
It's an interesting comparison, sports writer to art critic or drama critic.
Yeah, because I've often said that soccer, for example, the absolutely dullest game in the world to watch. It's a wonderful exercise, and I don't want to argue that point. But it is so dull to watch, and how many goals will be scored in a game? It's usually 1-0 or 1-1 tie, or 0-0, as they say. And yet the British could write about it beautifully because, among other things, the action and the goals didn't get in the way. It was like seeing a ballet, and that's the way they wrote about it. Or cricket, which is another dull sport to watch. I would much rather read a British cricket story or a British soccer story, none of which much I understand, than an American football story.
Let's talk about a couple of pieces that you did. You have a piece in your new book that's a profile of tennis player Jimmy Connors, and it's a piece about his background. It's almost a psychological profile, too. It's a lot about his relationship with his mother when he was growing up and as an adult. And you write after the piece, in a little postscript, that he wouldn't even talk to the press after the piece was published. What made him so angry about it?
I think it was revealing. I think it was terribly revealing. I think that pulled away a layer that Jimmy had kept around himself. He had just been sort of the kid, so to speak, and a pugnacious kid. And what I wrote about, as a matter of fact, the piece is called Raised by Women to Conquer Men. And it was his mother and his grandmother, who he called Two Mom. He was so close to her, T-W-O, Two Mom, that made Jimmy the tough kid that he was and gave him all his competitive juices. And I think Jimmy was a little reluctant to let people know that women had been so important to him. I think that he was a little scared about that. But even beyond that, it was just simply, I don't think we like to be unmasked. And he was very taken back by it. Subsequently, I learned that his mother, anyway, though she initially disliked the piece, I was told by friends that she had come to accept it as a very true and not altogether unflattering article.
Did that hurt your access to other athletes thinking, well, you know, he might write something about me, he might reveal something about me that I won't want written?
That's funny, Terry. I've never had that. I think I do have a reputation of being fairly fair and balanced. And so I think that's the main thing to have. And then I have had people, after I wrote an article on Bear Bryant, for example, I wanted to do an article on Coach Dean Smith at the University of North Carolina. And he told me, because he didn't like the Bear Bryant article, and he was generally mad at the press, that I could not interview him. But that's the exception to the rule. I think most athletes will accept you, most not only athletes, but other people as well, will accept you if they think you're fair. If they think you're a poison pen or a hatchet, then you're in a lot of trouble.
You know, I was thinking, I've heard a lot of your sports commentaries on Morning Edition, and really enjoyed them. And I might not have known about your work if it wasn't for that. And I'm thinking that you probably get exposed to a lot of people who don't follow sports that closely through broadcast commentaries. And that also made me think about how, in a lot of ways, sports is still a pretty male world. And I wonder how much that has changed. I know that there are women journalists breaking in some places there are women athletes breaking in. But for the major league type teams that you cover, they're male, period.
It's still pretty much a male province. First of all, what you say about National Public Radio, this is sort of family talk. But it is interesting beyond that, because so many people, and in this particularly women, say just what you said, that I never heard of you before, and I don't care much about sports, but I've listened to you for years on National Public Radio. There's no question that it's an altogether different audience for me, and I try to treat it that way. And sadly for me, I think what else you said is correct, that sports remains very, very much, and sports journalism particularly, a male province. And I've talked to some female sports writers who've simply left because it wasn't worth the fight, the aggravation, day-to-day, the bamboo shoots under the fingernails. Every time you go into the locker room, somebody is going to say something. Every second or third week, somebody is just going to bar the door for 30 seconds just to make it unpleasant, you know, that sort of thing. And after a while, you say to yourself, I don't need this. And the funny thing is, I think that if I were a sports editor, I would go out of my way to hire women writers if I possibly could, not because I'm a nice guy, but because if I wanted somebody to interview a 25-year-old young athlete, male, it stands to reason that he might open up to a young woman more than a young man. And so I think we're missing a real bet, just from a vocational point of view. I think we ought to try harder to get women into the field because, they should. I mean, to turn it around, I think I've done some of my best stories with female athletes because I think there's, I've always said that interviewing is like a high school date. It really is in many respects.
You really think so?
Particularly, not just...
I don't think of it that way.
Oh, well, you see, but you're talking about radio interviewing,
right,
which is
right.
What you do. And the kind of interviewing I do is usually done alone, often, in a den or in a cocktail lounge even, or over dinner, whatever. It's like a date. And the subject is trying to impress, the interviewer. and put on the best possible face. I mean, you do everything but bring somebody a corsage. and I play a very I think there's a certain amount of flirting that goes on. You play a role. I do. I'm the first to admit this. If I'm with somebody who's raucous and loud, I tend to put on that kind of the leopard changes his spots. If somebody is quiet and wants to go to church, hey, I'll go to church. And so there's an awful lot of that. And that's why I think it's really more natural in many respects to have the opposite sex interviewing each other. Whether it's a male interviewing a female or a female interviewing a male doesn't really make a whole lot of difference.
You know, in continuing with this male-female thing, I wonder if when you're traveling on the road with a largely male group of sports writers accompanying mm-hmm. male teams with male administrations running them, if there's this sense of behavior of, well, the ladies aren't here, so now we can really behave in the way that men behave together.
You know, there's a – I just – did a piece for Sports Illustrated about a month ago, a very unpleasant piece on Green Bay, Wisconsin, where three of the athletes have been involved in, everything from rape down to harassment in a bar. And some of the things I read suggested to me that possibly this is because when you're in this all-male environment all the time, it's much easier to, in the cliche term, look upon women as objects. And I think that what you're saying obtains there. I don't think there's any question. I quite understand why women don't want to be sports writers. To put up with this kind of environment, it's just you say, I don't need it. I'd rather go and do something where I've got a chance.
Has feminism penetrated into sports at all in the consciousness of the people who play it or run it? Do you think?
I still think it's probably less there than it is anywhere else. I'm still berated by male tennis players for my interest in women's tennis. I'm considered.
Really?
Oh yes, it's clearly that I'm considered a sissy. I mean, they say, well, you know, we could kill them. I mean, but that's not. Of course, that's not the point. It's like saying that the heavyweight champion can beat up the lightweight champ. But you do get this. I read something in the paper today that there was a suspicion that the NCAA wants to cut funds and so forth. And really, what they're trying to do, when push comes to shove, it's going to be to take funds away from women's sports.
We only have a couple of seconds left, so let me ask you this quickly. A lot of people have used sports writing as a stepping stone to something else. Now, you've written screenplays, you've written novels, but you're still writing about sports. Do you want to keep writing about sports no matter what else you do in your writing?
No, I don't feel that way at all. I would give a very sort of wishy-washy answer and say I'll keep doing it as long as it keeps coming, but I would walk away tomorrow if that's the way the cards were dealt.
That's interesting. Well, Frank DeFord, it's really been interesting to have you here, and I want to thank you very much for joining us.
I enjoyed it, Terry. Thanks.
My guest has been sports writer Frank DeFord. He's a senior writer for Sports Illustrated and a commentator for National Public Radio's Morning Edition. A collection of his pieces from Sports Illustrated has just been published. It's titled The World's Tallest Midget, published by Little Brown. My name's Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll talk with humorist P.J. O'Rourke. He's a former editor of the National Lampoon, so I hope you can join us. And now we're going to hear one of Frank DeFord's favorite comedy sketches.
Hey, Abbott!
What do you want, Costello?
Look, Abbott, I understand that you're going to be the manager of the Lou Costello Jr. Youth Foundation baseball team.
Yes, we just organized the thing.
Oh, you did?
Sure.
Well, I'd like to play on the team myself. You know, I know something about baseball.
Well, that would be accomplished.
Well, I'd like to know some of the guys' names on the team, so when I meet them on the street or in the ballpark, I'll be able to say hello to them.
Why, surely I'll introduce you to the boys. But you know, strange as it may seem, they give these ballplayers nowadays very peculiar names.
You mean funny names?
Nicknames, pet names, like Dizzy Dean.
Better Daffy?
Daffy Dean.
And I'm their French cousin.
French cousin?
Gouffet.
Gouffet. Well, now, let's see. We have on the bags, we have who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third.
That's what I want to find out.
What silly name? I say who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third.
Are you the manager?
Yes.
You know the fellow's name?
Well, I should.
Well, then who's on first?
Yes.
I mean the fellow's name.
That's it.
That's who?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
Who?
The guy on first.
Who?
The first baseman.
Who?
Have you got a first baseman?
Who is on first?
I'm asking you who's on first.
That's the man's name.
That's whose name?
Yes.
Now tell me who's on first.
That's right.
I want to know what's the guy's name on first
base. No, what's on second
base? I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who is on first?
I don't know.
He's on third. Now, we're not mentioning third. Now, let's get together.
How did I get on third base?
You happen to mention his name.
If I mention a third baseman's name, who did I face playing third
base? No, who is playing first?
I'm not asking you who's on first.
Who is on first?
I'm asking you what's
major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, jazz musician and composer Ornette Coleman talks about his 30 years at the forefront of the jazz avant-garde. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward looks back on the career of blues singer Wynonie Harris. Our book critic John Leonard has a review of Eileen Simpson's new book, Orphans, Real and Imaginary. It's part memoir and part social history. And we'll get the latest news from National Public Radio in Washington. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Now here's the news. This is Fresh Air. Our rock and roll historian, Ed Ward, has a profile of Wynonie Harris, whose style of blues singing influenced the early days of rock and roll.
Hold back the dawn. Stop all the clocks. I just got the news that my baby wants to rock. All she wants to do is rock. All she wants to do is rock. All she wants to do is rock. Rock and roll all night long. My baby don't go for fancy clothes, high class dinner and picture shows. All she wants to do is stay at home and huckle buck with daddy all night long. All she wants to do is rock. All she wants to do is rock.
Back in the late 40s, when rock and roll was a baby, the most dangerous music you could listen to was blues. Not the kind of blues we've become accustomed to today with a guy and a guitar, but the kind that was shouted by a big black man in front of a big black orchestra. Polite people would never admit to listening to it, and a big part of the reason for this was Wynonie Mr. Blues Harris.
Hey, boys! Did you hear that noise? Did you hear that thunder sound? Say, boys, do you know that noise?
Well, Mr. Blues is coming to town. Catch your business straight. Mr. Blues is coming to town. Catch your business straight. Mr. Blues is coming to town. You've got to stop that jive that you've been putting down.
Wynonie Harris was born in Omaha, Nebraska, but boy, he sure didn't advertise that fact. He'd rather you thought of him as the star vocalist of the Lucky Millinder Orchestra, the man whose battles of the blues filled the Club Alabama and Watts past its 900-seat capacity, the vocalist whose only living peer was his idol, Big Joe Turner, who he sounds a lot like on Tremblin'.
I ain't gonna tell nobody I'll never love again. 'Cause now I found a girl that's got me going in a spin. She keeps me trembling. Yes, I'm trembling. When she tells me I'm sweet, I tremble all the way down to my feet. She turned the light down low the first time we met, and then she gave me something that I never will forget. She had me trembling. Yes, I was trembling. From the way that I feel, I know this love must be real.
He'd want you to think of him as Wynonie Harris, drinker of whiskey, lover of women, and all of that was true. He was the last of the great blues shouters, although Big Joe Turner outlived him. For my money, he was a rootsier, gutsier singer than Jimmy Rushing and had a more powerful delivery than Roy Brown or Eddie Cleanhead Vinson. But he was working in a musical neighborhood nobody wanted to admit they visited, where you sang about whiskey and how good it made you feel, or recorded songs about women like Rose, Get Your Clothes, or, in perhaps his best-remembered shocker, bragged about how all the women loved his big 10-inch record of the band that plays the blues. But as embarrassed as people may have been by this tall, handsome man with the big, gruff voice, there's one thing about him that everybody concedes, albeit reluctantly. And that is that one record he made in 1948 changed rock and roll history by becoming one of its biggest classics. He wasn't even the first to record Good Rockin' Tonight. Roy Brown, who wrote it, was. But it was Wynonie Harris' version of the song that young Elvis Presley bought and memorized. As the 50s progressed, this kind of blues shouting faded away. Wynonie didn't successfully record rock and roll like Big Joe Turner did. He wound up running a tavern in Brooklyn and then lived in Los Angeles, where he'd once been a star. In 1959, he was dying of throat cancer, but he got a cab driver buddy to run him down the strip one last time, stopping in each of the old joints for one drink, then moving on. He was 56 when he died that June. Another 10 years and he would have been rediscovered by a new generation. Instead, they played his records and heard his voice asking if they'd heard the news. There's good rockin' tonight.
Fresh Air's rock and roll historian Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle.
Rock-a-bye, baby, in the treetop. Don't need no wind for Mr. Blues to rock. Gonna stop this rockin' today. Gonna stop this rockin', stop it right away.
Hey, Mr. Blues, don't you be no fool. The best thing to do is to play it cool. If you're gonna stop rockin', don't stop it now. We're gonna keep rockin' anyhow. Rock, Mr. Blues.
No, no, no.
Rock, Mr. Blues.
No, no.
Rock, Mr. Blues, won't you rock?
No.
Please, Mr. Blues, don't you stop.
You're listening to Fresh Air. Jazz saxophonist and composer Ornette Coleman has never played by the rules. When he went on the road with bands after high school, band leaders would sometimes ask him to stop improvising. In some cases, they would pay him not to improvise. He's 57 now and still making waves. When he hit New York in 1959, his radical music created pandemonium. Jazz critic Francis Davis writes in his book In the Moment that when Coleman and his now famous quartet first played, everyone took sides. Coleman was either a visionary or a fraud, and there was no middle ground. Davis writes, with Ornette Coleman, jazz established its permanent avant-garde, its new that would always remain new, comparable to the ongoing attack on tonality in classical music and on representation in 20th century art. Coleman has never been part of the jazz mainstream, but he's always gotten a lot of recognition. And this is an important time for Ornette Coleman. 30 years after he formed the original quartet in Los Angeles, they're getting together again tonight for a concert in New York. And he's just released a double album that includes the original quartet, Don Cherry, Charlie Hayden, and Billy Higgins, and Prime Time, a band he began in the mid-70s. Coleman travels with Prime Time to Europe at the end of the month. When I spoke to Ornette Coleman from New York, I asked him to remember back to the first time he played with the musicians that would become his original quartet.
I was going to jam sessions, and I guess we found each other, basically, because I had such a disappointment in playing in Los Angeles that I decided to get a day job. No, not really decided. I needed a day job. And when I just stopped going out, and then one night I went to a jam session, and a couple of musicians got very interested in what I was doing and told someone else, and then finally they contacted me, and I went out and found three guys, Don, Billy, and Charlie.
What did you tell them at early rehearsals when you were first starting to play together and you were playing a music unlike any music that had been played before?
I had told them, I said, you know, the basic of music is first learning how to play music on the instrument that you choose to play. Secondly, is to eliminate the problems of having a style to get in the way that you think or feel. And third is to not get so hung up in the technique of your instrument that you cannot play music anymore. So, and I demonstrated those kind of things to them. And since I first started, I was using just the trumpet, the bass, and the drums, which was lots of musicians at that time, so it was very simple for me to give them the information that I had figured out.
In 1959, you and the quartet moved to New York, and you opened at a club called the Five Spot, and that was maybe the most controversial engagement in all of jazz history. Jazz listeners, jazz musicians, and music critics really formed into two camps over your music and seemed to be constantly debating its merits. Who were some of the musicians who you remember coming into the Five Spot to check you out?
Well, that was Leonard Bernstein, Gunther Schuller, Miles Davis, Coltrane, Sonny Rollins, and people like that all came by.
Could you share with us one of your most vivid memories from that period at the Five Spot?
Well, the two most... One, I remember Leonard Bernstein coming up on that, we were playing, and when we got through, he jumped to the bandstand and started hugging everyone and me, and saying, you know, what a great sound it was. And then I remember one night, one musician kicked in the door with his feet and said very terrible things and tried to hit me, and, you know, so he was very disturbed about calling me an avant-garde four-letter word, you know. So it was really hot and cold at the same time.
In the mid-70s, you formed a new kind of group, a group you called Prime Time, and the group has two bassists, two drummers, and two guitarists. You frequently play in different keys and in contrasting rhythms. Did you hear that music in your head before you actually formed the group to play it?
All the time.
The record is a double album. One album features you playing in the setting of the original quartet, and the other album is you and Prime Time. What was the experience like of playing again with the original quartet?
Well, I really think that it came off very, very well because I went in the studio and had written about 16 compositions, and we recorded all those compositions within 4 minutes. And Charlie Hayden, which is a real purist type person, thought, well, you must be doing this to get more airplay, to get more popular. But I said, Charlie, you know, you've been playing with me for 25 years, and you really don't have to play a 10-minute solo, a 20-minute solo, to play something that you've been enjoying for 20 years. So why not try to find something that is meaningful to you, because you can do it instantly.
Your son, Donardo Coleman, is one of the drummers in your band. He also manages the band and has produced the new album. I believe you're divorced from his mother. Were you close when Donardo started playing drums? Were you close
with
him?
Well, I tell you, he came, when I first came to New York, he and his mother came with me, and we checked into a hotel, and I was opening, I think, on the 17th of November, 1959, and it was very cold and uncomfortable. And she said, you know, I really don't think this is a good environment to raise Donardo, and I don't want to raise him in this environment, so I'm going to go back to California. So I said, okay, that sounds fine with me, if that's what you want to do. But we kept contact, and when he became about I think it was 3 years later, I called him up and asked him what did he want for his 6-year-old birthday, and he told me something about some instrument, toy or something on the TV that he saw. I said, well, Donardo, you know, I don't know if I can find that instrument, but what about a set of drums? He said, I tell you what, Dad, he said, forget the toy and send the drums, special delivery.
That's great. So that's how he started playing drums.
Yeah, and I had gotten him a classical teacher to take the drums to him and give him some lessons.
When did you first play together?
When he was about 8. And then we made a record when he was 9. When he has time to do his own music, which I feel that I have neglected to give him time to do that music that is his own music, I think is just as popular as any other music, including my own.
Do you feel really lucky to have a son that you can play music with?
Well, I think luck is a very inadequate word. You know, I think a gift is a better word.
Yeah. Ornette Coleman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
All right. Thank you.
Jazz saxophonist Ornette Coleman's new album is called Ornette in All Languages. It's a double album featuring his original quartet and his band Prime Time. Listening to Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. Renee Montaigne, who co-hosts the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, Renee.
Hi, Terry.
The Iran-Contra hearings are back in session.
Well, yes, they are. This is phase two now, beginning today. And today, a former employee of retired General Richard Secord revealed that Oliver North had attempted to cover up the fact that he, North, had received a $16,000 security system from Secord. Also, you'll hear the second in our series on what happens to a company town when the company pulls out. Today, coal miners out of work in West Virginia and their union are fighting to get jobs back.
I hear there's a new arrival at the National Zoo down there in Washington.
Yes, there is. Ling Ling the panda has given birth to an apparently healthy baby. It's a rare event, and everyone's all excited.
Thanks, Renee. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. A few years ago, Eileen Simpson wrote a memoir called Poets in Their Youth about her marriage to the poet John Berryman and about being a woman on the periphery of a largely male circle of writers. Simpson has written a new book in which she reaches further back to her childhood when her parents died. The book is titled Orphans, Real and Imaginary. Our book critic John Leonard has this review.
Orphans is really two books, and one of them is very good indeed. That one is Eileen Simpson's memoir of her childhood. Her mother's death from tuberculosis, her father's death from ptomaine poisoning, boarding school days in a convent that may or may not have been an orphanage with a fancy name, hospital days in a sanitarium when it was thought she might have TB herself, teenage days in New York, torn between two families, subject of a custody fight and a quarrel about money held in trust. Living in doubt and denial, the child is never permitted to get past the mourning to the healing. She wants to be kidnapped. Mrs. Simpson was previously the author of Poets in Their Youth, a splendid account of her life with John Berryman, Robert Lowell, and other passionate post-war crazies. And so it comes as no surprise that the memoir portion of Orphans is every bit as wonderfully written as, say, Mary McCarthy's Memories of a Catholic Girlhood. It's an archaeology of the self, a kind of poem of consciousness. Moreover, it is written from the inside of the child. The child discovers her own secrets, one by one. There's no overlay or glaze of adult irony, nor is there any psychological bullying by the author. And this does surprise, because Mrs. Simpson in adulthood is a professional psychotherapist. She knows exactly where she's going. But we experience a child's fear and pain before we are permitted to read the grim fairy tale through adult eyes. Without parents, there are no Oedipal conflicts, but there is forever the threat of separation, abandonment, and death. The second half of Orphans is less satisfactory. We meet such real-life orphans as Coleridge, Rousseau, Tolstoy, Bertrand Russell, and Art Buchwald. We are asked to consider imaginary orphans in the fiction of Dickens, Charlotte Bronte, Mark Twain, Henry James, Thomas Mann, and Samuel Beckett. We are asked to think about half-orphans and psychic and emotional and spiritual orphans and the homeless and refugees. These little essays are oddly weightless. She can't really be saying that artists are better at their art for having been orphans, or that they choose to be artists in the first place because of abandonment. And to look at Thomas Mann and Henry James and only see orphans is to look at Balzac and Dostoevsky and only see boarding houses. Besides, some attention ought to have been paid to John Irving's last novel, The Cider House Rules, which brilliantly reconsidered the idea of the orphan and the 19th century that tried to contain that idea in literature. Finally, if orphan is to contain the psychic, the emotional, and the spiritual, everybody, in fact, that's dispossessed, it's an idea so elastic that it has no shape of its own at all. We might as well call it alienation. It's true that in some sense, in this century, we are all orphans. Alienated, marginal, exiles, refugees, Jews, a third world of the emotions. But it's not true enough. The real child orphan is innocent of art and history, and therefore defenseless. Mrs. Simpson gives us herself a splendid singularity, and then takes that singularity away, leaving an abstraction, a blank sadness.
Our book critic John Leonard reviewed Eileen Simpson's new book, Orphans, Real and Imaginary. Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine and is a columnist for New York Newsday. Here's what's coming up next time. On our next show, I'll speak with Patricia von Brandenstein, an Academy Award-winning production designer. You can see her work in the new hit film, The Untouchables. Also, classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review new recordings of Stravinsky's Rite of Spring and Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra, both conducted by Pierre Boulez. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts on the new Broadway production of Pygmalion, George Bernard Shaw's play on social class and proper pronunciation. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional assistance today from Lisa Bruton. Research assistance from Sue Spolin and Karen Murdrick. Our engineer is Audrey Voblitis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Fresh Air's theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. My name's Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.